Welcome back, everyone. I'm Arun Vanigopal in for Melissa Harris-Perry, and you're listening to The Takeaway. On Friday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in a bilateral meeting in Geneva with hopes of continuing discussions that will lead to Russia's de-escalation at the Ukrainian border. Here's Blinken speaking to the press after the meeting.
Based on the discussions today, Foreign Minister Lavrov and I agreed that it's important for the diplomatic process to continue.
In recent months, Russia has stationed an estimated 100,000 troops near its border with Ukraine. That buildup has concerned many of Ukraine's allies, who are increasingly worried that Russian President Vladimir Putin is planning to invade the country. Speaking with reporters on Wednesday, President Joe Biden commented on the situation.
It's one thing if it's a minor incursion and then we end up having to fight about what to do and not do, etc. But if they actually do what they're capable of doing with the force amassed on the border, it is going to be a disaster for Russia.
His use of the term minor incursion was criticized by the Ukrainian president Volodymyr Zelensky on social media. And on Thursday, President Biden attempted to strike a bolder tone, saying that any movement by Russian forces into Ukraine would be an invasion. But despite those words from Biden, as well as recent sanctions issued by the U.S., Russian leaders do not appear to be reversing course. For more on this, I'm joined by Kimberly Martin, professor of political science at Barnard College and a faculty member of the Harriman Institute at Columbia University. Good to have you here, Professor Martin.
Great to be back. Thank you, Arun.
All right, before we discuss how the Biden administration is handling this, take us back and explain Ukraine's relationship with Russia, and also tell us how has Ukraine's pursuit of democracy threatened Putin?
So Ukraine started out as being a republic of the Soviet Union. And then when the Soviet Union fell apart in, 1991, Ukraine became an independent state. And it has had a rocky road as an independent state, has gone through a fair amount of political instability. And the key events for what are happening now is what happened in late 2013 and early 2014, when Ukraine essentially had a revolution on behalf of Western-leaning democracy. And the reason that Putin finds that so threatening is the idea of having a successful democracy on his border in an area that comes from the same political background as his own country. Secondly, because he has felt that Russia should have a sphere of influence around its borders, especially in the former Soviet space. And I think third, because he has some criminal connections to particular wealthy oligarchs in Ukraine, and his own economic relationships might be somewhat threatened by what's happening in Ukraine.
What are Russia's security demands, and why have they been rejected by the West?
They are over the top. There's sort of three major demands that we know about. One is the argument that NATO should declare that Ukraine and Georgia will never be members, and that it should go against something that's in the NATO founding charter, which says that anybody who contributes to NATO security and who is a democratic country is welcome in NATO at some point. The second thing that he's really demanded is that somehow NATO stop supporting the countries that are already in NATO that have joined since 1997. So that would include Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic, the Baltic countries, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, and then a whole variety of countries that are in the Balkan region. And that obviously is not going to happen. And the third thing that he wants is a declaration that the United States will withdraw all of its nuclear weapons from Europe. And that also is not going to happen because the United States has nuclear cooperation arrangements with other countries, and they're all part of what has been in place for many, many years in NATO.
Given that these demands are so over the top from the perspective of the West and NATO, what do you make of them tactically speaking? What's he doing?
It's a big mystery what Putin is actually trying to accomplish. And I think what the negotiations over the past couple of weeks have actually been trying to do is give him some kind of an off-ramp so that if he changes his mind, if he decides that he doesn't really want to engage in some kind of new military activity in Ukraine, that he can declare victory to his home audience and go home with something that he can present to them as being something that he accomplished. I don't think that anybody believes that these negotiations are going to determine Putin's decision about what to do next. But I think nobody really knows what Putin wants, and he has given himself a huge number of options by creating this huge military force around Ukraine that he could use for a direct invasion, or he could use it merely to support the pro-Russian forces that are fighting in eastern Ukraine that have been since 2014, or he could launch cyber attacks. I mean, nobody knows for sure what he's going to do.
How has the Biden administration approached foreign policy with Russia and Putin compared to the Trump and Obama administrations?
Well, there's a lot of continuity from the Obama administration because Biden actually had responsibility for Ukrainian issues when he was vice president under Obama. I think there are two differences with the Obama era. One is on Russian behavior. Previously, when Russia took offensive actions of various kinds, they'd be tricky and sudden. And so the United States had to respond to something that had already happened. Whereas in this case, there's been this very long buildup over a series of months, and it's really not clear what Putin wants to do or what he intends, but it's been a much longer process. And the second difference, I think, is that Obama was very concerned not to do something that might provoke Russia to take action, whereas now it's clear that Russia might go ahead and take action. And so that fear of provoking Russia is not so much on the table as it was in past years. The Trump administration, in contrast, was just a mess, not merely on Russia policy, but on foreign and security policy in general. We know that Trump did not pay attention to his own military and intelligence advisors. Trump seemed to actually admire Putin. Trump didn't seem to understand the value of having relationships that were long-standing, decades-long relationships with our Western allies, with other liberal democratic countries. And so there's just no comparison between what Trump did and really what any president did before or hopefully will do afterwards.
Professor Martin, were you as disturbed by Biden's use of the minor incursion terminology as a lot of people in the, the commentator class were, or do you think it was overblown?
I think it was a little bit overblown. I mean, first of all, Biden has a longstanding reputation of making bloopers when he speaks. He is not particularly known for his oratorical skills. He's known for his policy skills. And so I think it's not unexpected that Biden might let something slip. But, you know, he also was just telling the truth. And so he was saying something that was obvious to everybody, that there are differences across the alliance. There are 30 countries in NATO. And so we have to expect that if Russia does not do something that is an all-out invasion, of course there will be discussions about what an appropriate response would be. So it's kind of unfortunate that it happened, but I don't think it was really anything that marred the diplomatic relationship about what is happening. We know that the Biden administration has just been doing a great deal of work, an incredible amount of work, sending Blinken and sending others to speak to European allies and other allies to try to get real unity on board.
One of the things that's being discussed in terms of a response is economic sanctions. Do economic sanctions actually serve as effective deterrents?
Well, that's a really good question. They haven't tended to be used as deterrents before. They're usually used when an action is already happening, just as a way of expressing displeasure and of trying to get whoever the sanction is against to change their behavior. So we don't have a lot of experience with sanctions as deterrents. We do know that Russia has adapted very well over the years to the sanctions that have already been placed against it. And we also know that European allies, especially Germany, but also France and Italy, for example, have very strong natural gas and other energy relationships with Russia, and therefore have very different economic concerns about sanctions than the United States has. The United States, frankly, has very little trade and investment with Russia, so it's much easier for the U.S. to put sanctions on Russia. I think two things are different in this case. The first is that there's been so much discussion among allies already, and they have been floating things like kicking Russian banks out of the international payment system publicly, which indicates that that's on the table, and it should be somewhat frightening to Putin that they're talking about that. But secondly, something that we haven't heard a lot about lately, but that was talked about a couple of weeks ago, was cutting off a special advanced semiconductor export to Russia, something that is useful for the Russian space industry and for the Russian computer industry, as well as the defense industry. And so that's a little bit different way of looking at sanctions.
Kimberly Martin is a professor of political science at Barnard College and a faculty member at Columbia University. Thank you so much, Professor Martin.
Thank you, Arun.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.